This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by our friends at Squarespace, the easiest way to create beautiful blogs and websites and push content to your social networks.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 79, Excessive Use of Katras. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the release date and pre-order bonuses for the new Star Trek console game, Brennan Braga's call for fan input on Enterprise Blu-ray extras, Data's appearance in a new GE commercial, and lots of Star Trek Into Darkness news. Then in the feature, we're joined by Catherine Bryan and James Morehouse to discuss Vulcans and the fourth season Enterprise episode, The Forge. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Chris, I am doing quite well. Thank you very much. I'm actually sore because I bought a TV this weekend and I actually lugged it home from Target, which was about a half hour walk.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm sitting here and I'm in a little bit of pain everywhere. But other than that, I'm doing great and my new TV is wonderful and worth it. So I'm quite happy. What about you?
That reminds me, I did something similar many, many years ago. Bought a desk at a furniture place, not so far from our house, and I decided that I could get it home by myself because it wouldn't fit in our car, and it didn't seem like it was going to be such a long trip, but yeah, I'll never do that again. Now, I understand that you bought the official television of all Star Trek fans, correct?
I did. It is 47 inches.
Of course.
How could I not? How could I resist? Even if they'd had another one that was cheaper and bigger, I still would have gone with the 47-inch one.
Of course. I mean, you have to. Absolutely. And when you watch Star Trek movies on Blu-ray on a 47-inch television, they just seem better, right? Bigger and better, right?
They really do. It really brings out the, I don't know, it highlights the specific technobabble things in it. Yes.
Oh, that's great. Things over here, it's Christmas Eve as I record, a little bit ahead of you, so I can tell you that Christmas Eve will arrive.
Oh, yeah. Good. I was a little bit worried, you know, with the apocalypse over the weekend, but you let us know the apocalypse didn't happen. Now you're letting us know that Christmas is on its way. This is really fantastic, knowing somebody in the future.
Right. Yeah. The apocalypse didn't happen, and the hopocalypse, as in the hopocalypse, don't confuse it with anything else, didn't happen either yet, but it may tonight.
Did you see that image of the Enterprise pulling Santa's sleigh?
I don't think I saw that, but
I guess they were the only reindeer in the quadrant.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, why don't we go ahead and hop into news and see what we have, and hopefully you'll make it through the show. I understand you're a little bit distracted by the sports ball today.
I am. There's a little bit of sports ball going on. The Seahawks, my Seahawks, are playing the 49ers, and if they win this game, they get into the playoffs. So I'm a little bit on edge here, but I will try to stay as focused on Star Trek as physically possible.
You know, longtime listeners will know that when you started doing this show, you just weren't into sports ball at all, and a while back, you bought the baseball game, the show PlayStation 3. I think it's only a matter of time before you buy Madden and you start challenging me to games on PlayStation.
Never. I'll never play a football video game. That's the line in the sand that I will draw.
This far, no farther.
Exactly.
It stops here.
But we do, in the news, have a game that I want to play with you. And hopefully, and now we have a date for it. We have some more extra things about it. And this is not football. This is actually Star Trek. This is the JJ game.
This is the JJ game that we have been seeing trailers of for what seems like forever now. And we finally have a release date. and it's available for pre-order. And I actually pre-ordered mine last night.
Oh, wow.
So nice. I have it all set to come here from the States when it's released. Now, the news that we got out from StarTrek.com the other day is that the game will be released on April 23rd. However, I went to Amazon last night, and they show a release date of March 31st. I pre-ordered, and it told me that they will ship it on April 2nd. So,
Interesting.
Who knows? You know, I don't know which is correct. It could be that Amazon has old information, and that StarTrek.com's is a new, updated release date. Yeah. Or it could be the other way around.
And, you know, it's a video game, and release dates slip anyway. I mean, people pre-ordered Duke Nukem Forever back, 10 years before it came well, out, and then it finally shipped.
That's a very famous case, yes.
I'm pretty sure they're going to try to get it out before the new movie.
Yeah,
but,
they will.
Other than that, whether it's the end of March or, as StarTrek.com says, April 23rd, it'll be out sometime in spring, and it's looking really cool. I'm hearing complaints, you know, oh, it's just another licensed game and combat system doesn't look great. But at least it looks really cool. It's got co-op. You can play one person as Kirk, one person as Spock. You're fighting against the Gorn. It's in 3D, so we can use our new 3D televisions that we've just purchased to play. I'm really excited for this.
Yeah, I am too. I mean, I don't know. It's not going to be... TOS original series movie type storyline in the game, of course, because
right.
A, it's the Abrams verse, and B, it's a video game.
Right.
I really don't want a game where I spend half an hour sitting around a table dining with the Klingon Chancellor drinking Romulan ale.
Yeah, I'm just imagining Romulan
very exciting.
Ale. What do they call it? Where you have to like push a button at just the right time. Quick time moment.
Right. Yes.
It's like, drink! Or don't drink. Yeah, that's riveting, riveting stuff.
That's right. And when Kirk makes an offensive remark about Earth history, you have to press X at exactly the right time to jab him with your elbow.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's being written by, I want to make sure I pronounce her name, Marianne Krawczyk, who wrote the God of War trilogy. So it's not like it's going to be amazing stuff, but it's not like they're not giving any thought to the writing of it. They've got actual video game writers working on it. Bob Orkey's working with her as well. So it's, you know, it's going to be what you'd expect, a JJ movie as a video game.
Now, did you play I think it was the last God of War game that came out for the PSP. There may have been another one since then. And I think it was Chains of Olympus, but I'm not positive. Mm. But there was a hidden scene in there when you go on the boat where you actually can sleep with the women on the boat. Now, I wonder if that's going to be written into this Star Trek game, and maybe Kirk might get a little Kirk action on here.
It's possible. I do want to see as Kirk grabs Spock to leave and they go to the turbo lift, if you push X at just the right moment, you hug Uhura and you get some extra points.
You get bonus points for hugging Uhura throughout the game.
You really do. And of course, we're really looking forward to that scene where you're on the Gorn homeworld, but out of nowhere, you have to fight an Andorian.
I'll take your blood to Andorra.
Exactly, because in the Abrams verse, apparently the Andorians and the Gorn are allies.
Of course they are. Now, Chris, you pre-ordered, and that means you get some extra special things.
It does, apparently. It says that because I pre-ordered, I will get the Elite Officer Pack, which features unique uniforms and exclusive items for Kirk and Spock. And
okay.
There's something else called the Brawler Pack, which is going to give Kirk a leather jacket and Spock a Vulcan Science Academy costume. Because apparently on Earth, you know, you ride your motorcycle around, you have on a leather jacket, you're cool. But apparently on Vulcan, you're cool if you wear a Vulcan Science Academy costume.
Well,
what does that
that's
say
why,
about the two different cultures?
That's why Spock is so cool, because the Vulcan Science Academy wasn't even cool enough for him.
Right. That's right. He wanted to go to Earth and get his leather jacket.
Right. And then there's even more. There's the Kobayashi Maru pack, where Kirk and Spock get to wear uniforms from, I guess, the Kobayashi Maru. And then there's the Stealth Pack, where they have stealth uniforms. And then the Kelvin Pack, where they have Kelvin uniforms. I'm starting to think maybe this is like Final Fantasy X-2, where you spend most of the game just changing your costume.
Right, or like us at Star Trek Las Vegas.
Yes, exactly.
Now, the Kobayashi Maru Pack, if you pre-order, do you actually get the apple that you get to eat during the game?
I hope so. I hope I'm picking off Gorn, and then as I'm reloading, I just take a bite out of my apple and then go back to shooting.
Just chomp on it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, I thought the Kelvin Pack, I thought that was where you get to play the entire game as if you're using the Kelvin filter on Instagram.
No, that's Mass Effect. I don't know if you've been playing that. At least the first one has this like intense film grain filter, and it's like, what are they doing exactly? It's kind of cool, but yeah, maybe they went a little bit too far.
Well, I'm looking forward to this one, and definitely we will find a way to co-op here despite the time zone differences. And
definitely.
It's going to be a fun one. So, moving on, what else do we have in news, Greg? This is something from Brandon Braga, I believe.
Yes. So, I actually, to be honest, wasn't entirely sure that this was Brandon Braga on Twitter. There have been some weird things here and there. Brandon at one point said that the fifth season, they were thinking of making it take place entirely in the Mirror Universe, which...
I think I've heard that one.
It doesn't make any sense, especially since, spoiler alert, Mirror Archer was killed off. So I don't know if they were just going to go Bacula-less. So I would say that not all the things Braga says are true. There have been more things happening since then where I've been convinced this is actually Mr. Brandon Braga of Enterprise fame, as well as many other things. But he's basically been asking people recently for help in putting together special features for the Enterprise Blu-ray, which I'm kind of surprised they're putting together an Enterprise Blu-ray at all, because if you look at StarTrek.com polls, it's pretty much just all Voyager, Voyager, Voyager.
Yeah, it is interesting. I guess they're doing it just because they don't have to do any kind of remastering on this series. All they have to do is just put HD content on a Blu-ray and
right.
You know, package it. And you know, the packaging isn't... It's not like when we used to buy the TOS or the TNG sets or the original Enterprise sets, which had very elaborate packaging.
Mm-hmm.
They're just kind of going through the motions with this Blu-ray packaging.
Yeah.
So they don't have to put a lot of money into the packaging of it, and they've already got the content, so you know, why don't we just put it out there on Blu-ray? I was thinking the other day, though, I certainly hope that they're not going to try to push the $129 retail price point for Enterprise Blu-rays, because I just don't think they'll sell very many of them at all at that price point.
Yeah, at least they do appear to be really pushing it on the special features. I know they're getting a lot of the people back in the studio to record commentaries.
Yeah,
I know Dominic and Connor were just in studio recording a commentary, I believe, for Shuttle Pod 1. And there's other stuff. Brandon's saying they're going to put a feature on about picking the theme song that everyone just loves. So they're really putting effort, whereas the TNG Blu-rays feels like they're putting all the effort into restoring the video.
Yeah, yeah.
And if all that the Enterprise Blu-rays were just, okay, here's the video that you can already get on Netflix, I wouldn't care. But I could easily see myself spending, you know, the $60 if they're going out and putting a lot of good special features in it. Even though, sure, I can get it for free on... Actually, I can get it for free on StarTrek.com and not even subscribe to Netflix.
Yeah, you can. I can't. If I go there, I get the whole, this video is not available in your geographic region thing. But I can get Enterprise on Hulu Japan in HD.
Right.
So... But I'm going to buy the Blu-rays, even $60-$70. I'll buy them. I would just like to have them in full HD and have the discs. And I know they're going to do extras. You know, I wish that... Okay, one thing that Brandon Braga said on Twitter, his actual tweet, there were two of them back to back. He says, okay, Trek fans, here's the deal. I want to know what you want to see as part of the Star Trek Enterprise Blu-ray extra material. And then the next tweet. So please tweet your ideas, and I will try to incorporate them. any episodes you'd like to see with commentary, questions answered. Now, for me personally, I really, really think, especially with Enterprise, because it was done so recently, they really should be doing commentaries for every single episode.
They should, yeah.
And I don't want them to pay a bunch of money to bring Scott Bakula and Jolene Blaylock and people back in. I want to hear from the writers. I want to hear commentaries from the creative staff. And that should not be that difficult to pull off. I mean, Battlestar Galactica did it.
So say we all.
I mean, that's really true. And I think they even did some commentaries while the show was on the air. Or at least they were doing a podcast.
Regeneration has commentaries on the Borg fan collective set. Yeah.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
Or maybe even on the Enterprise DVD set too, I think it has commentaries.
Yeah, but yeah, every episode. Why can't every episode have commentaries? I know Ronald Moore doing that for Battlestar, especially doing it while the show was on the air, was a brand new thing. People don't do that. But I think it could be done more. And when it's something like a reissue, like you're trying to do a big Blu-ray, why not say every episode with commentary? Because that's something you're not going to be able to get on Netflix or iTunes or any of those things. So we'll see. We'll see what they get on there. I'm sure they're trying to do as much as they can. And hopefully, they're not spending a lot of money trying to get Jolene Blaylock in to talk about her role. Because, that's not really what we care about so much.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And, even the later seasons of News Radio have commentaries for all the episodes. Now, you would never expect that, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's right, everyone. I'm going to continue to talk about News Radio on the Ready Room.
Oh, goodness.
Just wait till we start newsradio.fm.
I'm really looking forward to that one. Yeah.
All right. But anyway.
The one tweet I did send to Brandon was that I really just want to see a couple discs of special features where it's basically like, what if they'd made more episodes of Star Trek and what would those episodes look like and what would the actors look like as they were acting out full episodes of Enterprise, and completed effects and sound effects and, yes, season 5, please.
I think every disc, every season set should have a special half-hour feature called Manny Koto's Magic Bag of Hindsight, where Manny Koto tells you how he would have changed each season of Enterprise. And then, of course, on the fourth set, you get that disc, the special two-hour feature, Manny Koto's Magic Bag of Hindsight, about season 5. And, bionic Porthos, half Romulan T'Pol.
Actually, I'd love to hear Manny Koto doing a commentary for the seasons he wasn't on. I don't know if you've heard the Generations commentary, but I'm pretty sure he knows Generations better than that film's director does. Because he's on with Carson. He's like, oh, yeah, I love this scene. Carson's like, oh, yeah, we did all that, didn't we? Yes, I forgot about this part. So, yeah, if he can just come in and just do, all of season 1, that'd be great. He can say how he'd do it differently, what he loved about it, all of that stuff.
And did he do a Frakes Surtees thing here and say, wait, you've seen this movie, right? You directed this movie, right?
He really should have.
All right. So if you're interested in sharing your thoughts with Brandon Braga about what you would like to see on the Enterprise bonuses, his Twitter username is @BrannonBraga. Very easy to remember. Just send him a tweet. Tell him what you want to see on the Enterprise Blu-rays, which are currently slated to come out sometime in 2013. My understanding was in the first part of the year, maybe in the first quarter, but I don't know if that's really true or not.
Yeah, and no word on any sort of Fathom special event, theatrical releases. We haven't heard anything about that. But I
don't think that's going to happen, Greg.
Probably not. Not going to happen. As much as I would love it to happen, I think the most we can ask for is Blu-rays.
Yeah. They should do the entire third season marathon in the theaters. The whole Zindi arc, nonstop.
Sure. That'd be great.
It would be slightly shorter than Meet Joe Black.
Right. Well, people were in there for the extended Lord of the Rings, right before The Hobbit. And I'm sure people are going to go to see all of Lord of the Rings and all of The Hobbit. They'll see all of that. So that's pretty much the length of Enterprise Season 3, right?
Yeah, that sounds about right. All right. Well, moving on, Greg, this is a real quick one here. General Electric released a new commercial called Robots on the Move, and a familiar android appears in this commercial.
Yes, and you'll have to tell me what happens in this, because I've heard Data is in a GE commercial, but I've not actually had a chance to see it yet.
It's not. It's just a TV commercial, and they're going through and they're showing you different robots through history. So, you know, the robot from Lost in Space, I think, is in there. There's a lot of different famous robots. I think even Kit from Knight Rider is in there.
Nice. I hope they included Satan's robot from Bride of Chaotica.
I don't think Satan's robot is in there, even though that is the best robot ever.
It's the best robot.
Robbie the robot from Forbidden Planet, which is possibly, I think, for me anyway, the most famous classic robot, even more famous for me than the robot from Lost in Space is in there. Johnny Five from Short Circuit is in there. And then as they pan across, there's Data back there in the background.
Just hanging out, sort of like it's the most toys.
Yeah. He's just hanging out.
He's in a seat, waving.
That's right. It's like the most toys, except this guy just has a complete robot fetish. And he's just collecting robots from throughout history.
So many robots. It's kind of creepy, G. What are you doing there?
So anyway, this is a commercial. You can watch it on YouTube. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. And just wanted to mention that it was there. Now, someone asked Brent Spiner on Twitter if he received financial compensation for having Data appear, which is, of course, a very legitimate question. You know, when it comes to licensing, one thing you really have to be careful about is when you use the likeness of an actor on merchandise, because the actors should be getting royalties as well for that. And Brent actually did respond to that person. What did he say, Greg?
He says, I never discuss finances with 1,354,331 people.
Great. Which sounds exactly like something Data would say, right? So specific.
It really does. Yes. Wow. Okay, Brent. I thought maybe you weren't Data, but maybe you actually are Data, in fact.
Maybe you really are.
I'm sure he got paid. CBS got paid. Paramount got paid. Probably the Roddenberry Estate was paid. Rick Berman, Maurice Hurley. The list will probably go on if you actually look at how these licensing deals work.
Definitely. And I think that Spot even got a year supply of Happy Cat.
All right, Chris. Well, I think it's about time to take a moment and have you tell us about something you like.
Well, Greg, you know what I like? You know what I really like? What I really like is our sponsor, Squarespace, and I'm really serious about that. They do make it possible for us to bring you the shows, but beyond that, you know, I've been using Squarespace for years. Even before I even started Trek FM, I've been using Squarespace, and it has made my life as a web designer and a content creator immensely easier. And recently, they launched the new Squarespace 6, and they have brought some incredible new tools.
Yeah, I love that it has a drag and drop interface. That's the one thing that really strikes me. Every time I don't have a site of my own really to do, but I like, you know, I work in Trek FM and I want to be able to help you out with that. So I've been playing around with Squarespace 6 a little bit. I like you can just grab like a picture and stick it right in there and just put it there. I can do HTML. You know, I think most of the listeners of the show can do at least some HTML. But the internet's gotten so complicated where you have to learn CSS and JavaScript and all this stuff just to make the website look the way you want it. Squarespace makes it so much easier.
You know, what's really cool, you mentioned the drag and drop in the images. Some of the technology behind Squarespace 6 is really amazing. One thing that it has that is great for building richer websites and richer blogs and getting when you get a site as large as Trek FM and you have so much content and you want to make sure people can find that content. And in Squarespace 6, you're able to assign an image thumbnail to every post. You're also able to specify whether a post is a featured post or not a featured post. And what's cool about the images in the image thumbnail is they have this little circle. It's called a focal point. And the system makes some decisions for you about how it displays the thumbnail image to represent your post based on what kind of template you're using. And you can actually drag this little circle around the image and set the focal point within Squarespace so it knows that when it serves up this thumbnail, it's going to shift the image up and down or left and right so that wherever you put that dot is the center of the image when it's shown as a thumbnail. And that's, it's really amazing to me. I've been doing this for so long, and I'm so used to having to create images that are exactly the way I want them to display in every situation. And it saves me so much time because I can create one image and then I can actually tell the system just by dragging my finger on my trackpad where I want that focal point to be. And that has been a very impressive feature and a huge time saver for me.
That's phenomenal. I mean, there's guys at Squarespace, they know the internet. They know how you want it to work. Like, they know that you want people to be able to see it on their, you know, their 1080p 3D television all the way down to their iPhone. And they know that the web has to work in different ways, but you also don't want to have to build an iPad site. You know, I see even people like ABC have this terrible mobile version of their site. Just like, no, just have a, if they had a system that scaled down the site so it looked just a little bit different automatically, it would save them so much effort and make it better for the readers as well. So I think you're finding that as well, that people are going to enjoy looking at the site however they're looking at it because of the incredible stuff that Squarespace is doing behind the scenes.
You mentioned Trek FM and a large site, Greg, and the last two points I want to hit on today are the fact that you can have contributors. You know, Trek FM, we have a lot of editors, and we are able to assign different people as contributors. And so, you know, I can go in and post things and edit. You can, Char can, Landru, whoever can go in, and you can assign the privileges that those users have to edit the site. And it's so easy. And then the other thing is that Squarespace is search engine optimized. And that may sound like a throwaway phrase. Everyone's into SEO these days. But, you know, what's wonderful about Squarespace is that they do all the work for you. They make sure everything in the code is set so that it's optimal for search engines, and you just worry about your content. And that's, I think, the way it should be. So give it a try. Go to squarespace.com/trek. Use the offer code TREK12 to get 10% off. But you don't have to actually pay right up front. You can try it free for 14 days, and all they ask you for is your name and email address, and you get the full feature set for 14 days, and then you can decide if you want to sign up. And if you do, there are two plans. It's very simple. There's an $8 plan, and there's an unlimited for $16, and you can take 10% off that using offer code TREK12. So go support Squarespace and support Trek FM.
Say either, and I say either. You say neither, I say neither. Either, either, neither, neither. Let's call the whole thing off. You say potato, I say patata. You say tomato, I say Creole tomato. Oh, let's call the whole thing off.
All right, Greg, let's move into movie news and rumors. And
yes,
apparently, Paramount released a totally different synopsis for Star Trek Into Darkness since we recorded our last show.
Yes, Paramount detonated the latest synopsis and everything it stood for. As Drew said on the latest Observation Lounge, apparently they got someone who actually speaks English to do a synopsis.
I know. That first one was really weird.
I don't know what was up with it. It was just odd. All the word choices, I don't know.
You know, I was talking to Larry, and Larry said, never in the history of a Star Trek press release has a single line been ridiculed more than detonating the fleet and all it stands for.
Probably in the history of film press releases just ever. Like, I don't think a film synopsis has ever been pulled apart this much.
Right.
Like, when they released the synopsis for, you know, like, Michael Bay's new film, Pain and Gain, I don't think anybody even read the synopsis. They, like, scanned it, okay, blah, blah, blah.
Do you think any movie sites took the original synopsis for Pain and Gain and then the new revised synopsis for Pain and Gain and wrote, like, a 3-page dissertation about what's different in the wording?
I'd have to check painandgainmovie.com to see. They are hard at work getting some of those exclusives.
All right. Well, let's talk about the new Star Trek synopsis.
Yes.
You know, your dramatic reading a few weeks ago was a really big hit. Would you like to do a new Movie Trailer Man dramatic reading?
I would love to, Chris. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me on the show to do this today.
All right. Let's do this.
In summer 2013, director J.J. Abrams will deliver an explosive action thriller that takes Star Trek into darkness. In the wake of a shocking act of terror from within their own organization, the crew of the Enterprise is called back home to Earth. In defiance of regulations and with a personal score to settle, Captain Kirk leads his crew on a manhunt to capture an unstoppable force of destruction and bring those responsible to justice. As our heroes are propelled into an epic chess game of life and death, love will be challenged, friendships will be torn apart, and sacrifices must be made for the only family Kirk has left, his crew.
Well, that was just totally different than what they said the first time there, Greg.
Yes. It's different in some certain small ways. No longer is the fleet detonated.
Right. That, and in the fact that it sounds like it was written by someone who actually can write cohesively.
Yes. Well, I mean, the original, where it was an unstoppable force of terror from within their own organization has detonated the fleet, everything it stands for. And that's only part of the sentence.
Right. The first thing that stood out to me here in this one was that they removed the word pioneering director. J.J. Abrams is now simply director J.J. Abrams. He's no longer pioneering director J.J. Abrams. So apparently his pioneering days are over.
They're over. He's now settled. He's a settled director. His Oregon Trail days are behind him.
I guess so.
I didn't actually notice that. I was told from one of these news sites that the first paragraph is exactly the same, so I didn't even look. But no, you're absolutely right. He's simply director.
I don't know. I have to say, to me, it sounds like the same movie that they described the first time. But
some of the confusion things, like it's said, you know, they go to a war zone world, and now that's been taken out. So I don't know if it's just not talking about the war zone world or if it's just being clear that they just kind of meant Earth. And it also doesn't refer to anyone as a one-man weapon of mass destruction. And it kind of makes it sound like there's bigger forces at play than just one guy, which makes me happy.
Right. I think it's future guy. This is the whole temporal Cold War coming into the Abramsverse, right?
Which apparently, I don't know how closely you've been following at Brandon Braga, but future guy was going to be Archer.
Yeah, I knew that. Yeah,
I just don't know how that was going to work out. And I want to have like a long conversation with Brandon Braga about what exactly that would entail.
I thought if future guy had turned out to be Porthos, I thought that would have been like an even more unexpected twist. But
I could totally see that working. But yes, no, I'm sure this is future guy. He's the one pulling the strings. Again, as Drew mentioned on the observation lounge, the bad guy is not actually Harrison. It's not actually Cumberbatch because he's not canon. The canon villain is, in fact, Carol Marcus.
Yeah, I saw that too.
So that she's the unstoppable force of destruction.
That's why she's screaming when her plan goes awry, and she realizes it's not going to work out, you know.
And that's why she starts screaming.
That's right. What do I do now? I don't know. All right. So anyway, so yeah. This is the new synopsis. Really for me, it sounds basically like the same movie that they mentioned before. What I find more interesting is the second trailer that was released right after we recorded last week's show.
Pretty much immediately after we recorded.
Yeah, right.
Yes. But now both of us have had a chance to see it, so we can happily talk about it on the show. But I've not heard your thoughts at all, Chris. What did you think of what we saw here?
It's kind of interesting that I feel like I got a better feel for the movie from the teaser trailer than I did from this one, just because this one is so quick. There are so many flashes, flash, flash, flash of everything, which, I like that actually in the trailer. I don't like trailers where they just give the whole movie away.
Right.
I think back to 1996 and First Contact, where I felt like I knew too much about what was going to happen in that movie based on the trailer. And
in a world where the Borg Queen goes back in time to assimilate the Enterprise and Data to stop First Contact with the Vulcans, but doesn't manage because Picard manages to turn Data in time. And they live happily ever after.
And sacrifices must be made for the only family Picard has left. His crew.
Yeah, I thought that was a bit much. That's the only family Picard ever had, really.
But, so I like this trailer. I like that it's very exciting. It makes you want to go see the movie.
Yeah.
It does definitely paint this as an action movie, which will satisfy the purpose of the trailer in the theater to get more non-Trekkies to come see this movie. You know, it's right up there. It's Bad Robot. It's J.J. Abrams. It's exciting. And it happens to be Star Trek. But based on the synopsis, I am still confident that this is going to be an interesting story that's not just an action movie for the sake of an action movie.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it's still a teaser trailer. It's very much designed for a wide audience. And for that reason, it's doing its job. It shows some incredible images. I mean, still, that Federation ship plunging into San Francisco Bay, like I can't deal with it. There's never been something like that in a Star Trek film, much less any of the shows.
And we know for a fact from this trailer that we are going to get some Uhura kiss action, because it's right there in one of the flashes.
Yeah.
We know from some other stills that we've seen that Simon Pegg Scotty is going to get some Uhura hug action.
Yep, we saw that. An interesting thing in this trailer that you might have missed because it went by so fast, and you probably haven't had a chance to watch it frame by frame as I have, but they actually have Anton Yelkin's Chekhov in a red security uniform.
I think I did notice that.
Yeah.
The other thing I noticed was that there is a scene of Kirk near the end where he appears to be in a cadet uniform, not in his gold tunic, because even the emblem on his jacket is different.
Yes. The Chekhov from Mudd's Women.
That's what I'm doing on the screen. It's more like the... And I have to go back. I haven't watched the 2009 movie in quite a while, but the shape of the emblem, it looks a lot like the ones from the motion picture where it has the circular... Yeah.
It is the motion picture emblem. Yeah. That's something we noticed this week. And I don't know what that means. Why does he have a motion picture? Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know, except in the 2009 movie, were the cadets wearing that emblem on their cadet uniforms?
Now, the cadets have pretty much what Harrison is wearing in everything we see, where it's that black tunic with a weird sort of inset
like screen
leather
printed?
Or something. Yeah. Yes. Yes, some sort of... That's what all the cadets wore.
Okay.
This new emblem is something new, and
Yeah.
Obviously, in the original Prime universe, the Delta logo is only for the Enterprise.
Right.
But in this universe, it's for the entire Starfleet, which they're explaining that it was the Kelvins originally and Kirk used it. But then when something big happened with the Kelvin, Starfleet decided to take it for everyone. So maybe what it is that evolution of emblems is moved up as well. So they've already gotten to the point where this is what they're thinking of using. It's so weird, though.
If that moves up, does that mean that in the third J.J. Abrams movie, they're going to be wearing pastel too much junk uniforms?
Well, this is something I did not talk about last week when we talked about the IMAX preview. Basically, Kirk is wearing a wetsuit when he comes on the bridge, and yeah. Yeah. It was inspired, I would say, by the motion picture uniforms.
Did Uhura break up with Spock in that scene and run over and hug Kirk?
Well, she was very worried about Spock because Spock was about to get melted by lava. But okay. Maybe when that was over and she got a chance to have a good look at Chris Pine, I think she might have had second thoughts.
Maybe so. But when I saw that scene in the trailer, I mean, my first thought was maybe it's a flashback scene to Kirk as a cadet. But then the emblem's different. And so who knows? Who knows what that is?
A lot of stuff could happen. Yeah. But my favorite part of the trailer is Chris Pike at the beginning saying, you know, that he has admiration for Kirk, but he has not an ounce of humility and he's going to get everyone in his command killed. Mm-hmm. It's just like in the first film, every time Pike talked to Kirk, he was saying wonderful things to him. You are so amazing. You're so smart. You could be captain in 4 years. You're first officer now, all of this stuff. And something has happened to make Pike have real doubts about him, which I'm assuming he's talking to Kirk. That's the definite implication it makes. And I'm wondering what Kirk does to make Pike lose faith in him.
Well, at least it shows that there's been a passage of time between these movies, because we were concerned about, you know, Kirk, he kind of ended up captain of the ship in this bizarre way. And, you know, if the next movie just picks up right away, it's going to be hard to buy the fact that he's in command. But I'm sure a lot of this will be filled in the Countdown to Darkness comics, though.
Yes, which are coming. We're getting Countdown to Darkness starting in January, and they're going to switch ongoing to being sort of flashback stories. So we're going to get these really cool building up to the movie comics for, I think, 5 months, five of those, right up until the movie. It's by the same team who did the original Countdown. It's going to be the same writer, the same artist as well. So there's going to be continuity there between Countdown and Countdown to Darkness.
I know we're going to be getting the backstory of Bones, and we're going to be getting the backstory of Uhura.
Right.
At least. And we already have Keenzer. You know, they did that first because he's the most important
character
to cover in the comics. Yeah.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to them doing the backstory of the guy from the Andorian fight scene. Because I just want to know, you know, Jeff Combs is everywhere. How did that happen?
He is everywhere.
Right. That's information I
want to
know.
How did he manage to get everywhere into the entire universe?
And why is he so angry at everyone that he has to fight everyone in every episode? I want to know. There's another thing in the trailer here, Greg, that I followed through on. And TrekNews.net, Brian at TrekNews.net pointed this out. If you pause the video at the 1:07 mark, there's actually a link that reads ruthe1701.com.
Right.
And if you go to that URL, which I did, you are presented only with this black screen with type that says ruthe1701. If you click it, it asks you for your name, your country, your birth date, and your email address. Mm-hmm. And then when you click that, you get another screen that just says, we will let you know when the search begins. And there are links to the Twitter account for this, which only has one tweet right now, and the Facebook page. So it's some sort of viral marketing campaign that's going to surround this movie. I don't know yet what it is, but I did sign up, so I'm looking forward to getting an email and finding out what's going on here.
Yeah, I'm hoping I'm not just going to start getting spam emails from, you know, ThinkGeek trying to sell me Enterprise pizza cutters. It sounds like it's going to be something really interesting. And the fact that they put it in the trailer, the Twitter account only has like 3,000 followers. So this is something that hasn't really hit, you know, mainstream or anything.
Right, yeah. Mm. I'm sure they'll make a bigger splash with this as we get closer. Right now, it was just kind of slipped in there. And maybe a few people picked up on it as they were watching, maybe, although I didn't see it go by. So it's really, it's like a subliminal thing, I guess.
Yeah.
But Brian pointed it out there, so I went and checked it out. But yeah, go check it out, ru1701.com.
Hmm.
Now, Greg, a couple of other quick items here as we wrap up news. And you can give me your thoughts on this, because you're a little better versed in this stuff than I am. J.J. Abrams says that he pitched the villain for this movie as a combination of Hannibal Lecter, the Joker, and Jack. So what do you take of this? Jack from The Shining, I should say.
That's Jack from The Shining, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting combo. You know, I've heard them talk about the difference between this villain and, say, Nero from the 2009 film, where Nero was very just about being strong, like an intimidating presence. His ship was huge and futuristic and dangerous, and he can blow up entire worlds. But that's where it basically stops. There was no mental component to it. Whereas when you look at that list, you know, the Joker, Jack, and Hannibal Lecter, the scenes of those films that are so strong are, well, especially not including from The Shining, but their conversations with the hero, where it's like, I'm the other, you know, the other side of your coin. You know, you're the good side, I'm the bad side, but we're really the same coin. And it looks like Harrison, or whoever Harrison is in reality, sees himself as, you know, someone who's doing good from his point of view, the same way that Kirk is. And that can be, you know, some of the scariest bad guy you come up against. You know, Hannibal Lecter actually does some pretty good stuff. He helps out the investigations, but yet he's more than happy to eat somebody if it comes around to it. And, you know, you talk about the Joker and all the terrible stuff Joker did and the looking for chaos. But he also felt like he needed Batman there to be a pulling. He felt like they both needed to be there to keep Gotham on edge. If Harrison has that sort of relationship with Kirk, that could be a really cool movie. Or even if he has that relationship with Spock, where Kirk wants to stop him and Harrison kind of wants to be almost stopped, but he's like one step ahead because he's playing with them. This is sounding really cool and much more of an interesting dynamic film than 2009 was.
Yeah, it definitely does. I was just thinking that, of course, I'm glad that J.J. Abrams was thinking about the villain in this way to give more depth to the villain, because I don't want this cookie cutter villain. I get tired of watching our crew just fight against a cardboard cutout bad guy, right? And then you know how it's going to be resolved. It sounds like it'll be a much more intricate movie. But I was also thinking that as much as people are ragging on this movie right now, and I've seen just a lot of hateful tweets about this movie, people just, which I don't quite understand, because we haven't really seen enough of it yet to make any kind of judgment on what it's really going to be. But from this information, and we should mention that this comes from the special event that we had here in Tokyo back beginning of December. I think that was on the 11th, wasn't it? Or the 4th. Mm-hmm. And he said that there. People may look back at this and see Harrison here as one of the best villains in all the Star Trek films, because he may, and especially with Benedict Cumberbatch, I mean, if anyone's watched Sherlock, you know what a great presence he is on the screen. I mean, this Harrison character, whoever he is, could go down as one of the greatest villains, along with Khan, which, you know, I'm not going to argue that Khan is probably the greatest villain in the Star Trek films, at least after the whale probe. But I think people are going to watch this movie and come out of it and say, well, that was actually a really good movie and a really good villain.
I hope so. The villain is the thing I'm most worried about. You know, that's what we've been talking about since the very first Ready Room, when we talked about this, that we wanted it to be somebody strong, somebody interesting, somebody that could fight Kirk you know, on his own level. And I didn't want a whale probe. I didn't want a Nero. I didn't want a Cybok. So the fact that they're going, as much as, okay, it's another terrorist, it's the Dark Knight Rises Star Trek style, that's the sort of films that are working, especially right now. That's what's connecting with people. And so I don't have a problem with them going in that direction at all.
The tenuous nature of relations between humans and Vulcans was one of the basic foundations of Enterprise, and it evolved over the course of the series, but it took an unexpected turn in the fourth season episode, The Forge. And today we're going to talk about The Forge, and to help us do that, we have with us Catherine Bryan. Hello, Catherine.
Hi, guys. I'm very excited to be here tonight.
And we also have with us someone who I believe was played by Jeffrey Combs.
He is everywhere.
In The Awakening, the second part of the story, it's James Morehouse. Hello, James.
Hey, guys. First podcast. Ready to go.
So, James, I mentioned that you were playing by Jeffrey Combs because you actually did appear in this trilogy of Enterprise.
Yeah, diehard Trekkie my whole life. Won a online charity auction. Thank you, Mr. Tom Paris. And was able to appear in Awakening. And it was everything you could hope it could be. Fired the phasers. Put the ship on red alert. Appeared on the bridge in uniform.
Did you get to touch some of the blinkies?
Oh, I was all over the blinkies. Pushing everything. They showed me how to do it. Had an explosion over my head. Did the whole shake.
Nice.
We had it all. I had it all for 2 days on set. Could not have been more fun.
Wow. Did you get to meet Seth MacFarlane while you were there?
No, but we do have that in common, Seth and I, as Enterprise extras. I was excited that B'Elanna Torres, Miss Roxanne Dawson, was the director of Awakening, so that was cool.
Roxanne holds a special place in my heart, so that would be very cool.
Anyone who listens to the show knows how much Craig loves Roxanne Dawson. Although he loves B'Elanna more than Roxanne.
Any girl wearing makeup, like mechanical prosthetics on her forehead, really.
That's right. Okay, well, let's talk about The Forge. We were going to talk about the whole trilogy, but you know, we've tried to do that in the past on The Ready Room, and we kind of missed a lot of the details we wanted to talk about. So we're going to take this one at a time, and we're going to talk about The Forge today, the first part of the story. So, Greg, why don't you lead us into The Forge?
Yeah, well, we've talked a couple times before in the past about this being the Vulcan show, you know, Enterprise being the Vulcan show. And this trilogy is a lot of that. Although, you know, even before this, we've gotten a lead in as far as we've known, okay, these Vulcans are kind of different than we've seen before. You know, Spock would always say that Vulcans can't lie. We've seen a lot of Vulcans lie over the years. They even were a lot more emotional than we're used to seeing. And, you know, fans hated it. I never really had that big of a problem with it because I just figured, oh, well, they're earlier Vulcans. They're more interesting Vulcans. So I'm not going to complain about it. But what The Forge starts to put in stark relief is that they're different for a very specific reason, and that's that there's actually a reformation coming to the Vulcans that's going to see this culture transform into the culture that we see in the original series and forward. And that's just, it's one of those mind-blowing things when you realize, oh, that's what, I mean, maybe it's not what they were doing the whole time, but at least now that Manny Koto's here, he's made that the thing that they've been doing this whole time.
I kind of feel like that's what they were going for the whole time personally, but this made it clear to people. The problem is that they had lost most of the audience at this point. Yeah. So the people who were put off by the way the Vulcans were portrayed early on, which, as I've said on here many times, was a very realistic way of portraying the Vulcans, I think, more so than the very superficial portrayal that we got in the later series in, on the timeline.
Yeah.
People were kind of put off by it. And so,
yeah, I think now, they showed more of Chakotay's past and his things that he was doing with the stones and the spirit animals than they did really with Tuvok the whole time. He would go and he'd meditate sometimes, but we never really fleshed out the Vulcans any in his time on Voyager.
Yeah, the problem is that from Spock or Tuvok or any of the other Vulcan characters that we got on TNG or the baseball playing Vulcan on DS9, you're always focused on an individual character, whereas, you know, you want to actually know them as a society, like the way we got to know the Cardassians on Deep Space Nine. So that's what we finally got here.
This was definitely the first series where I was actively afraid of the Vulcans, starting with that episode, Fusion, where we're first introduced to the mind meld in this series. And after that, it made me a lot more skeptical about the Vulcans and made me question more their motives, which I hadn't really done definitely in the earlier series.
Greg, I think you summed it up perfectly. How I approached it at the beginning with the Vulcans and the way they set it up, I had no issue with it. And I'm a hardcore Trekkie from TOS way back. I never had one issue with it, always thinking this was some type of progression they were gonna show.
Right, because that's what you want to see. At least that's what I want to see, is a progression, right? If they're going to go back to the 22nd century, I want to know how they got from there to the 24th century. So it's natural that the Vulcans would be different, and how did the Federation form, too? And that's what I like in the overall story here of these three. I know we're only going to talk about the Forge, but the fact that this involves mistrust between Vulcans and humans, mistrust between Vulcans and Andorians, and these are the founding worlds of the Federation. I think this story and the two that follow are great examples of Enterprise getting it right when they're building this bridge between where we are today and where we are when we go aboard the Enterprise with Kirk and Spock or Picard and Riker later on, even though it's criticized often for failing to do that. But I actually think they did it rather well.
Well, I think you really hit on it where you say that there's multiple Vulcans that we're seeing. I think that's a big part of seeing a larger culture, is seeing more than just one aspect. Like, even with the Andorians, we only really get Shran, and we don't get a sense of what the larger Andorian culture is like, which is fine. We only have so much time. But Vulcan, we're really getting a chance to see that. I love the opening scene between Forrest and Saval. These are two, you know, really they're minor characters. They're not in every episode, certainly. It's sort of like DS9, where occasionally you'll get two recurring characters having a conversation. And it's one of the more interesting conversations where Saval reveals that the Vulcans are afraid of humanity because of how they remind them of themselves.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a realistic portrayal, I think, of the society and the fact that the Vulcans and humans, they haven't known each other very long at this point, from first contact to now. And we know from other series, you know, Spock even has talked about how barbaric Vulcan history is, and maybe even more so than human history is. But it all gets covered up later on. And so that conversation, and where Saval talks about how they are kind of afraid of humanity, because he says that it took them 1,500 years to rebuild from their great wars. I mean, they basically set their entire culture back to the Dark Ages, for lack of a better Vulcan word. And then they watched humans recover in a century and take to the stars. And they know that humans have this brutal instinct that Vulcans have. And they can't really read humans either. I think they find humans very puzzling. And they haven't known humans long enough yet to truly understand them.
Yeah.
And so there is that fear. And I find that very interesting. And it's another aspect where Enterprise at this point, like you said, does have a little bit more of a DS9 feel to it in terms of realism.
Yeah, what did you feel about that opening, Catherine? What really struck me was talking about how what makes what makes humans different from the Klingons or the Andorians. But I was wondering, what did you think of that conversation?
Well, I think it was really interesting that they decided to open it with forest sacrifice for a mm-hmm. Vulcan, which we haven't yet really seen the humans and Vulcans interact in a totally positive way. There's always been the friction between the two, not just because of Vulcans seeing themselves not as superior, but as sort of guiding humans a little bit. And Forrest's decision, he doesn't think about it. It's not for any political gain. It's not for any human gain. It's just he sees that Soval is in trouble and he just goes and saves him and sacrifices himself, which I think says a huge, huge amount about the human-Vulcan relationship that we haven't seen yet.
Yeah, Chris, you were hitting on a little bit there. When Saval says that, I mean, I think he actually says we're afraid of humans in a way mm-hmm. that they have this aggression and ability to take the fight to somebody, but then at the same time step back and reason through problems and logic and use that side of it, and that they'd never seen that before. And I think that, I mean, that sets the tone for this whole, for the three episode arc. And then Greg, back to your point, some of the setup for all of, some of the criticism for all of Enterprise is based on a fallacy in terms of these things like, oh, Vulcans can't lie. I mean, again, from day one of TOS, Vulcans can't lie, but that was never a hardcore literal truth to Vulcans, but yet so many people take that criticism through the 80s, through Next Gen, through DS9, and make it part of their criticism or inconsistencies of Trek or how it's portrayed, and that drives me crazy.
Well, yeah, I think even a lot of the times the writers took it to heart. I think in Voyager, they painted Tuvok as much, way too two-dimensional character. He would do things, and they'd have to finagle everything to make him justify it as, well, I wasn't really lying because I was doing blah blah blah. It's like you don't have to go through all those extents. Like, Vulcans have more dimensionality to them. Even Spock did. I mean, if you really look at Spock, he wasn't like that. But Enterprise was the first show really to say, look, we don't need to worry about it. We can do this on our own terms. We don't have to rely on the canon. We can sort of paint Vulcans in the way that makes them the most interesting.
But if we're talking about Vulcan portrayal, I mean, you go back to Gambit, and
that's true.
And here's, you know, some nefarious dealings. There's these DS9 Vulcans from Take Me Out to the Holosuite. They're not good guys. These are not nice guys. They're pretty arrogant.
I don't understand that episode at all. I don't.
Sports ball.
I saw somebody, Tristan Rydell, the international sex symbol, did his question of the day on what Captain XO combination you'd like to see. And somebody said Sisko and Spock.
That was me. Come on, Greg Harmon.
That was you?
That was me.
All right.
It would be fantastic.
All right. Well, defend yourself, because apparently Sisko hates Vulcans.
No, I think we exchanged tweets on that. Sisko does not hate Vulcans. I mean, that's a broad, you're broadly generalizing the way people who criticize, Vulcans don't lie. Sisko has issues. He has a past, but to label him as a racist who hates Vulcans would be inaccurate. But those two together would be awesome. Spock and Sisko, come on.
No, Sisko had an issue with this particular Vulcan captain
and his entire Vulcan only crew, which I don't understand.
Well, they had a history. It's a sports metaphor. He let it get a little too far.
Yeah, I don't think it was against the crew, though. It was against this particular captain, and there was a back history that, and the captain happened to be Vulcan. So,
I just want to see the other one where they play football against the Andorian crew, and then, you know, they have water polo against the, you know, Talaxian crew.
The problem with the Andorian football team is that they're the most penalized team in the whole Federation League because they're always starting fights.
Don't try and block with this. When he swings, intercept, deflect, and hook it away.
Better to insert between the eyes and twist.
Yes, they are.
Just gotta whack off their antenna and you're set.
That's true. Yes.
Yeah. I like the helmet design for the Andorians, where it has the hard shell to cover the antennas. The problem is, you know, the horse collar tackle is illegal in football here on Earth. The antenna tackle is illegal in Federation football.
Unnecessary Andorian roughness would definitely be a problem. I could foresee in that sport.
Antenna interference, something like that.
Give up. A single stroke and there'll be no pain.
You think I'm losing?
No, it's that wacky ready room.
I want to ask you guys real quick what you thought of what Saval says, because he says that humans, you know, they can classify every other race really easily. Like Klingons are violent and Andorians are kind of nefarious and the Tellarites look like pigs. But humans, that he says, humans are hard to nail down because they're all sorts of different things. Does that click for you guys? For me, I like the idea, but it also feels really like rah-rah humanity. Like, oh, aren't we so special?
When I heard that line, basically the only part of it that I listened to is humans are hard to nail down part. The rest of it, it's just the writers leading up to make this point, because of course you're not going to be able to classify any race. Any society is going to be complex. You're not going to be able to pin them all down. I mean, it goes back to the whole case that we made about how the Vulcans were portrayed prior to Enterprise, where they were like a cookie cutter race that, you know, was logical, had no emotions. Then they concealed their emotions. They don't lie, you know, which we know it can't possibly be true. So what I think about what Saval said was simply that I think he makes a good point about societies in general and humanity, because of course the story is about us as humans.
That bit always sat a little bit weirdly with me, just because Enterprise worked so hard to show us different almost fractions of the Vulcan race, to show the different levels and the different sort of attitudes that they portray. So to say, oh, humans are complex because they're so different, seems a little bit hypocritical almost.
Well, he was saying humans are different from the other, not from Vulcans, but from the other races.
We see it in the other races too, though. Like they go out of their way to show different kinds of Klingons. Like there's the lawyer Klingon, and then we get the healer Klingons.
I don't know if I would say they go out of their way. I always thought the Klingons were portrayed two-dimensionally throughout all of Star Trek. They do show a few cases where they have a different Klingon, you know, not just a warrior, but it was very little. I don't think they went far enough.
But let's not overthink it too much. Greg, to your point about it being the rah-rah humanity, we are the leaders of the Federation. I mean, it was humans that put it together and got it launched in a short window of time. So that's kind of part and parcel to the 750 hours of Trek.
Yeah, that is true. I kind of like – well, I like an archer to George Washington. Which apparently that's said in David Goodman's book as well. He talks about Archer being George Washington, and Earth is kind of the United States. You know, you kind of figure when the eventual one Earth government happens, it'll kind of be led by the U.S. Like that just seems to be what's happening.
Or China.
And I think Vulcan, I know, but I think Saval's kind of talking to Archer like he's the president of the United States. You know, maybe it's like Tony Blair saying, look, there's something about you guys, then you're kind of special and you're able to lead everybody. Yeah, it's kind of like a rah-rah humanity thing, but it kind of seems to be true, as you say, in the Star Trek universe at least. There was no Federation before humanity came around.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, naturally. I mean, they're not going to write a show where humans are not the central point of the show. I think your world government point is kind of interesting, because I think that from an American perspective, yes, things are leading that way, but like James said, maybe China.
That's true.
Now, I don't think it's going to be China, because I think they can't sustain what they're doing, but I think that it would be interesting to see how a world government in the future evolves, and I don't necessarily think it would be led by the U.S. And actually, in order for it to work, it can't be led by one nation like that. That's just going to continue the conflict, but anyway,
well, at least the way they're putting it in Star Trek is, I mean, they're speaking English and not French.
well, English has become a global language, but yes, within Star Trek, it's very natural that who is it that always says, you know, Star Trek, the Federation is basically America in space.
Right,
is
yeah.
It, on our show recently. But it's true, and it's natural, because it's an American television show, and it's being written by American writers. So,
but
of course,
I think
that's how it's going to be.
Your point is well said, that the main thing Saval was talking about was that humans are complex. And that is an interesting thing for the Vulcans to be very aware of. And that is what makes them so worried. And that leads us into talking about Vlas, who is the head of, is it the Vulcan Science Council?
High Command.
Yes.
No, he's the head of the High Command.
The High Command is the term, right.
Yeah.
And he's an interesting character.
He is. And he is, from the first time we see him, even before we find out what his real agenda is, as we go through the longer story, he seems very abrasive and arrogant, and he's, but not arrogant in the, like, the Tuvok way of, like, I'm a Vulcan and I'm, you know, so wise, but more in a human way of arrogance. And it's interesting because he's very different from any Vulcans that we've seen in the past, and you feel uneasy at first. You feel like, yeah, there's something going on here with this guy.
He reminds me sort of Admiral Layton from Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
That's a joke. Okay. Robert Foxworth played Admiral Layton.
Yes, and, exactly. Yes. That's good. I was waiting for you to continue.
Yeah, okay. All right. Anyway, yeah, he's not a good guy. And he's obviously has an agenda. And you see that right away in his machinations of how he manipulates everything going on.
Yeah, because right away he's, you know, he's got his little, his pet henchman, right. the head of the crime division, that says, we have a suspect already. And it's like, oh really? It's like, oh yes, we're absolutely sure it's this lady from this cult that no one has heard of, and they've really not ever been violent in the past. But they totally blew up Earth Embassy, even though they have no problem with Earth. Maybe he didn't think through the whole plan as well as he could have, but he at least had a plan right off the bat. The moment that Archer calls, he's going to be like, yes, we know what's going on here.
It's like he had it in his little, you know, in a little cabinet just waiting for any sort of problems with Earth to just be like, I know who to blame it on. The ones hiding in the caves, the ones that are totally unassuming. It was them.
Right. Probably was. Yeah. Like there's a string of like hover car robberies and it's the Serenites probably. Someone's breaking a 7-Eleven. That was totally the Serenites, guys. Really.
They're just the Vulcan Fall guys.
Yes, exactly. Just blame it on the Serenites when in doubt. But Vlas, they're hiding in caves. Nope. They're here.
Yeah, they traveled all the way across the forge and they planted those bombs. Yeah.
But you kind of believe it when you're watching the episode. You know, when they first say...
Well, that's true. Yeah.
When he first says, you know, we have proof that there's, you know, it's our guys who find the Vulcan DNA on the bomb. So it's not even like they come to them with that. It's like they went and investigated and found out, oh, it must be this that's going on. So Vlas is intelligent. He's not just laying it all out and expecting them to believe it.
I feel like it definitely helps that we've been tricked into just trusting Vulcans a lot of the time in the other series. Not so much Enterprise. They're really sneaky and nefarious on Enterprise most of the time. But when you're watching the other series and you see Spock, and if he tells you to do something, you're like, yeah, no, that's probably what we should do. I definitely trust him. But I think that's half of why, for the beginning of the episode, you're just like, oh, man, it was totally this terrorist group I've never heard of. I buy this.
Well, yeah, there's always, like, how many times have we heard there's this terrorist group that's doing bad things? It's like, we go to a planet, there's a terrorist group that's causing trouble, we have to stop them. Yeah, so I totally buy into this being what's going on.
One thing I liked about this, and like you said, we are kind of tricked in to believing this at the beginning, because I think we naturally believe that this would be the case, because first of all, on our own world, in our own society, we do have terrorists who carry out attacks like this. But in past Star Trek, especially on TNG, this would have been such a simplistic story. It would have been a very clear-cut, you know, it'd be something like the High Ground or some very clear-cut thing where there's this terrorist organization on the planet, they blew up Earth's embassy, our crew would help the government track them down, and everyone would be brought to justice, and then we would all go sit in 10 Ford and have a drink, and we'd fly off to the next mission, and everyone would be happy.
Yeah.
The way that they handled it here is, it's very interesting, and I think shows the complexities of Enterprise, that they really make you believe that, yes, it could be T'Pau.
Yeah. Of course, and there's the one wrinkle that it's T'Pau.
Well,
and if you're paying attention to who T'Pau is.
If you're paying attention, yes. But she's not, some people will write in and not believe I'm going to say this. She's not like a super well-known character in Star Trek. I mean, we know her from Amok Time. And yes, it was a huge role, but it was one episode.
Yeah.
It's not like she's an ongoing character that everyone knows so well. And there are so many Vulcans, you know, to this, to that. That, and she looks completely different here, and she's young. She's like 32 years old, I believe, is what Flux says, 32, 35.
Yeah.
And so you do have to be paying attention. And you're, oh, yes, that's T'Pau. But even that's interesting to me, that you're paying attention, and you're like, wow, that's T'Pau? T'Pau was a terrorist? And you really do believe at first that the Serenites, maybe they are a terrorist organization.
Yeah.
Maybe T'Pau is a terrorist. And just that rewriting of Trek history, rewriting of T'Pau's background at the beginning is very interesting.
It is, yeah. And you mentioned she's young. That's actually the reason that T'Pau isn't T'Pau. It really is. There's a lot of T names. But they were originally going to have T'Pau be the science officer on Enterprise. But they looked at the timeline and were like, that just does not really work. But this is a so much more of an interesting thing to do with her.
Yeah. I'm glad they didn't do that, because that ties into my whole thing about how they overuse characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't always end well when they do that on Enterprise, no.
But I gotta say, I think the strength of this entire episode and this story arc is T'Pau and bringing her into this storyline and connecting it all the way back to the original series in such a consistent and strong way. And to your point, Chris, about kind of the setup and how maybe in Next Gen or some other episodes, more of a rote kind of ending where it's a little bit obvious in terms of the terrorist. But the bait and switch here with T'Pau is genius. And from my standpoint, when I found out I was going to be in the episode that debuted T'Pau on Star Trek, yeah, I was pretty geeked out, I got to tell you. It was not just an also-ran episode. It was a big one.
So while we're talking about T'Pau and the Serenites, well, why don't we talk about the Serenites just a little bit more? Because I like the way that, again, what I wanted, as much as I liked the first couple of seasons of Enterprise and its kind of slow talkiness and all, which a lot of people don't like, I really liked when Manny Koto came on and season four became more of what I think everyone wanted, which was fill in the blanks, the back history of Star Trek. And we know about the Vulcan path to logic, and we know about kind of the turmoil in the society. Introducing an element like the Serenites here, finding the Kirshara, introducing the Serenites, introducing the struggle between this group that wants to lead Vulcan back to logic versus the government, which under Velas has really become very militaristic. Now, he's the leader of the High Command, which was supposed to be in charge only of space exploration. So they're kind of like NASA to us now. But here, they have clearly begun governing the planet, or they have a lot of influence over the planet, almost in his actions, and Velas's actions, a militaristic or a dictatorial way. Setting up this whole back history and conflict and having a group like the Serenites makes the Vulcans so much more real to me. But what are your thoughts on the Serenites themselves?
I just think it's really interesting that they chose to sort of rewrite what we knew about how the Vulcans viewed logic. Because when you're watching maybe TOS or TNG, you assume that there is only the one way that they view logic, and that they don't have maybe sort of different conflicting ideas on how it works. But to introduce this group who are saying that they found the true path to logic, and it's one that we haven't heard about maybe before, and one that is so different than what we've heard, I think it was a really good path for Enterprise to take, because that's my favorite part, I think, of the whole show, is the way that they sort of change what you think you already know about Star Trek.
Well, yeah, and we'd started that with having the mind meld people, where, you know, we find out that most Vulcans don't mind meld, but we have this split off group that does mind melding. But to talk about it being this larger group that's also doing mind melds, and you're starting to get this picture that, huh, there is this deep split. And I love how they draw the parallel to Earth religion, and how the actual original writings of Serac have been lost, and that opens it up to interpretation. I can't think of another show like this that really fleshes out a foreign culture to that extent. Like, you go to a planet, you go to a city, and that city is exemplary of the entire planet. And the one person you meet is like, that's what those people are like. Like, Talaxians are like Neelix. And if you meet another Talaxian, he's Neelix, played by another actor.
Right. Because all Melmacians are like Alf.
Exactly. And Orkians are all like Mork.
That's right. The one case I'd say, Greg, would be the Bajorans on
That's
DS9.
True.
But there is this scene in here where, and I may be mixing up The Forge and The Awakening and Kirshara, but when T'Pol tells Archer that, oh, you think this is amusing, and he says, no, I think it's familiar. He's talking about exactly what you're saying there, that, you know, finding the writings, and they've been lost, and they've been left open to interpretation. And he says, yeah, this sounds a lot like my own history on Earth.
And you say it's like the Bajorans, but I even feel like with the Bajorans, it was the right path, and then there was also the wrong path. Whereas with the Vulcans, we're seeing everyone has sort of, well, there's these different beliefs. And there's a unified belief that's coming that's been missing for so long. And it's not that Vlas is evil in his methods to keep the status quo. But I think even so, most of the Vulcans aren't evil in wanting to keep the thing they believe. And we see this in T'Pol's having to deal with, oh, I guess the thing I've believed for so long is not the correct path. We never really see Kira deal with something like that. There was the emissary and her having to deal with Sisko being the emissary. But to see this whole shift in what their culture is and what it's about, we see that with Saval too in this episode where he decides to do a mind meld. It's something that was distasteful to him last week. But now he's starting to see that it's a thing that Vulcans not only can do, but should be doing.
Okay, I can see that, yeah.
I think there's a lot of examples in the 750 hours of Trek where they dive into cultures and show different viewpoints and different character traits that doesn't just your Neelix reference. I mean, that's probably a pretty good one. But with Bajor, there's a lot of good examples of of broad characterizations and different viewpoints and different philosophies. With the Sirens or the Sirenites, to me, this is one of the high points, not only of Enterprise, but of Star Trek in terms of how they flesh out all of the Vulcans through... I know the conversation between Archer and Siren in the cave is just so good. There's just so much there in terms of diving back into, you know, what is, again, 700 hours of Star Trek and making it all come together.
Yeah, I really liked the part of this episode where they're wandering through the desert and they're attacked by sand people. And Obi-Wan Kenobi comes out of the desert and does a cry out dragon call to scare them away. That was awesome.
Sir, yeah, I wasn't expecting that.
I haven't gone by that name in a long time. A long time.
That was Obi-Wan Vulcanobi.
Exactly.
But come on, how awesome we get to see a Sailot. Literally, after 720 hours of Trek, awesome. We get to see a Sailot. Fantastic.
You know there was that one really person cool. That's been waiting for that their entire lives.
That was me.
Yeah. Oh,
okay. That was you? Okay, well, thank you.
And I don't know if it's the case, but I can only imagine that Manny Coto being on here had a lot to do with us getting to see the cellite, because he's such a Star Trek fan that
yeah,
bringing all those elements back in.
Remember, this article was written by Judith and Garfield Reese Stevens. It was their first ever episode after writing for Star Trek for so many years with the novels and books.
Yeah.
So,
and they write some of the best novels.
Pretty sure they wanted to dive in there with that yesteryear reference from the animated series.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this definitely reads like a non-canon novel, and I'm so glad that it's canonized by being an actual episode, because it's one of the, there's a lot of times you'll read a book and you're like, this is really cool. I wish that this is going to affect anything else ever. Like, you only really get that with, like, the books Jerry Taylor wrote that eventually got, you know, pulled into the show itself. But most of the time, you know, you read a TNG novel and you're like, oh, that's really cool, but it doesn't have any effect on the rest of the universe.
Yeah, when you're talking about it during the time of the shows, not much gets in there. Now, the novels these days, they almost all affect one another as you move forward. They've become extremely complex, you know, and the writers talk to each other and, you know, try to coordinate so things have a linear nature like you would get on television. Yeah. But they were very much standalone.
It's kind of the new canon, because there's not new shows, and there's probably won't be new shows, at least for a while, especially in this universe. So you're getting that new canon. But the time, let's have Judith and Garfield write an episode of Star Trek. Let's have some of those great things, ideas they have floating around, really make it into the show. And as you say, Manny Coto, too, is going to allow stuff like references to the original series. I think if this was still the original, like, first season, it would have been, you know, T'Pau or something that just was almost T'Pau, but not quite.
And to your point, Greg, this episode has so much in it. It's so vast. It's so epic. They're shooting outside the sets in the studio in the desert, you know, north of LA. And with all of that expansive, epic storytelling, there's no scene on the bridge. It's one of those few episodes with no scene on the bridge.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head by saying that it feels like a like a novel that became canon and became an episode.
It's definitely one of the episodes that doesn't feel like it's sort of winking at the fans of the other series. It sort of starts to take off by itself and say, this is what we're doing now. This is what the Vulcans have been up to. And it's not what you would expect.
Right.
Yeah, very true. I wanted to keep talking about Siren, although in this episode, he's not Siren. We don't find that out, I think, until the next episode. He's still called, what did he say? Arev, I think?
Arev,
was the name he was going with. But he was really interesting. I like the way he started quizzing Archer. Like, oh, if you're here on a pilgrimage, then of course you know so-and-so's first law of metaphysics. That was just...
Well, actually, he pulls the exact line from Star Trek IV at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
He says, who said that logic is the cement of our civilization with which we ascend from chaos using reason as our guide? That's just straight out of Spock's retraining. That was a nice little...
Yeah. I love they can slip that in there and it doesn't feel... I don't know, maybe it's that the actor didn't realize he was making a reference, or just that they didn't build up to it with, like, you know, do a big mutiny zoom on his face before he makes it. But it just felt like a natural thing, just what he would have said. And it just so happens that it does tie into the show. But it's so often that doing a tie-in shrinks the show, but this is a case where it's expanding it.
Yeah. Although the Jeopardy music that they played after he asked was a little bit inappropriate, I thought.
Probably.
Ka-ching.
There wasn't enough suspense yet.
I think those tie-ins reward people who have put their time into Star Trek, and I never think they make the show any smaller. I love any kind of little throwaway reference that shows somebody's doing some work and connecting.
Throwaways are good.
Yeah. This kind of reference, it is. The ones that bothered me are the way that Janeway likes to reference Kirk or other people.
Those are
like reading off of her screen. Well, Coco, you know, Captain James T. Kirk used to always say, like, look, I don't need the Kirk reference, okay?
Right.
Why don't you give Robert Beltran some lines for a change?
Right. Some of those can be
in
forced.
Unification. Yeah. But like a unification where they name a Vulcan ship the T'Pau.
Yep.
That's just perfect. And that just rewards you for knowing who she was.
Yep. And when you're talking about that exchange between Arev and Archer, we have that exchange about lying and about Vulcans never lie. And right away, Archer's in his face saying, I've dealt with the High Command. I think he said the High Command. And I've heard some whoppers.
Yeah, right. He says Vulcans can lie and cheat with the best of them.
Right, perfect. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so could we move to having what I think is a conversation that we need to have just as a society about mind melds?
Oh, I want to hear that.
This is a thing that's been weighing on my mind for a really long time. I live in fear of the Vulcan mind meld.
Yeah, really. Because they'll mind meld you. It doesn't matter if you're unconscious, if you don't want to be mind melded with. And even our heroes, like I'm thinking Star Trek VI, where Spock mind melds with Valeris. It's like, what are you doing? Like, really, this is really creepy. This is not right. Am I the only one who feels this way?
Who are you to judge the Vulcans and their society?
Well, okay, when he's mind-melding with an unconscious human security officer who signed no consent form.
No, I think he did. I actually think Phlox had that consent form on file. I'm sure Tucker was had that all lined up.
Yeah, it's like in the Two Towers where Wormtongue has the King Theoden King sign the death order, and it's like a huge like scribble that goes. Bleh. Yeah, I think that's maybe the security officer did that.
I'm pretty sure it's part of the paperwork. When you graduate from the academy, you get assigned to the ship. We don't see this on the show because it's just not very riveting, but there's this big stack of forms that you have to fill out. I'm pretty sure one of them is that I consent to being mind-melded with by a Vulcan should the need ever arise and it involves the safety of the ship or crew.
Right.
And you have to sign your name there. And
I will take on any Katras I will be mind-melded with and have my thoughts stolen. If I come in, if there's any Einar around, they can just read my thoughts whenever they feel like it.
For a society that's working so hard to make mind-melding acceptable and part of their culture, they're just really abusing their gifts by just thrusting it upon terrified people.
On behalf of the extras, it's one extra, unconscious. It was necessary.
That extra has a family.
He got some screen time.
That's true.
That extra has to go home and live with the consequences of their actions.
It's invasive.
I just think if you want to mind meld with someone, you need to talk with them, have a conversation, explain to them that there are dangers. You know, remember what happened to Picard after he mind melded with Sarek? Like, there are dangers of mind melding, and it never feels like they think these things through before just my mind to your minding.
Well, Tucker and Phlox don't know that.
Well, Tucker says, I don't care about his mind. I don't care about his body. I just want to get that information out. Then he can die. I don't care. Thanks, Trip.
I think it's a good point, James, that in Star Trek, in TOS and TNG, and every time we see mind melds in those series, it always feels to me like it's a very simplistic plot device. We need to move the story forward. Let's have the Vulcan mind meld. And it's just something Vulcans do. They're aliens. Look, they have pointy ears. They're not humans. They have this magical power, and we're just going to have them do it. We're going to get the information so we can move the story forward. But I feel like Enterprise, through the series, because we have the whole situation of T'Pol being forced to mind meld and, contracting this disease as well, they actually do portray it as it's an ability that Vulcans have, but it's taboo. And as a society, they're trying to come to terms with how it should be handled and what kind of consent is required. And they are messy with it here. I mean, Saval does just grab the unconscious extra, even if the extra loved it, because he got some extra screen time from that. I think it's realistic. It's a society trying to figure out an issue, and it's rocky. And so mind melds here in Enterprise are more interesting to me than they are later, because I feel overall they're not simply some kind of magical plot device. They're actually a real issue that they're talking about.
And I'll give it a little bit of a pass, considering it is Enterprise. That might have been Saval's first mind meld, or at least one of his very first, certainly his first with a human. He hadn't thought through the ramifications. And yes, I'll give it more of a pass here. And maybe it is. Maybe I need to retcon in my head that even Spock was still dealing with this being a new phenomenon. And maybe he hadn't thought through, you know, a mind meld as a torture device. You know, he just was thinking, well, this is a thing I can do. Why don't I try it? And, you know, maybe in another 100 years, they'll be a lot more evolved about their use of it.
Do you think in Star Trek VI that when he mind melded with Valeris, he was just thinking, oh, this is something I can do. I can try it. Because I never felt that way at all.
I'm really creeped out and angered by that scene every time. So I'm trying to do anything I can to give Spock a little bit of an out.
I agree that it's inappropriate for him to do that, but I think it was a situation where he felt it was necessary. It was the only way.
It was a ticking time bomb.
Well, but there's also, remember, there is a relationship between Spock and Valeris, and I think that he felt angry, and the Spock in The Undiscovered Country was a Spock who had moved past this pure logic. I mean, he even tells Valeris that logic is only the beginning of wisdom. It's not the end. And I think that she was his protege. He had gone to bat for her, and he felt very betrayed by her and very angry, and he had to get that information. I think there was a lot going on there besides simply grabbing her face and mind meld, forcing a mind meld on her on the bridge.
Well, how about putting his Katra in bones? That seems like a rather self-centered move. Like, I just don't want my soul to die. I'm just going to put it in the first person I see.
I know, but they were like brothers, you know? It's like your family, you're passing...
I start saying you're passing something
onto your family. I don't mean
Chris,
it like an heirloom.
Chris, you're on the mark.
It was like a last-ditch effort. And I think he knew that ultimately, as much as they bickered with one another, they loved each other. And I think he knew that Bones would want to help him in the situation. I don't think that it was... Yeah, I don't think it was an inappropriate thing for him to do.
Yeah, you're probably right. I do think, though, that the Vulcans take a... What is it? It's better to ask forgiveness than permission?
Well, yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
my point on this whole thing, not to beat a dead horse, is to go back to some of the criticisms of Enterprise. And early on, people were like, oh, mind meld is taboo? It's deviant behavior? That's no good. That's wrong. That's not how it is. But they did such a good job of portraying that infusion and stigma and then this trilogy to make it all work and sync and align perfectly with the original series and Spock, who mind melds with a Horda to save everyone.
And I don't think that Horda gave consent either. So
The Horda was on board.
Yeah, I think so. The Horda signed the form, but then it rolled over it and it incinerated the form. So that's why you didn't see it. You saw that black trill? That was the form.
That was its mark.
On the other side of the rocks, said Meldai.
There you go. Well, if nothing else, it's great that Enterprise gives us a chance to have this conversation. As you say, it adds such depth to every aspect of Vulcan culture. Like, who would have thought that the mind meld used to be taboo and that they're still working through when it should and shouldn't be used? That's just really cool.
It is.
Isn't it far more interesting than simply Vulcans can mind meld with people?
It is.
Okay, so while we're on this subject, kind of one more thing I wanted to talk about here. If I have any issues with this story, and we've talked about it a little bit here because we've been talking about mind melds, and nothing against Judith and Gar, because the story, they always write fantastic stories, but I felt like many elements of established Vulcan culture were overused a little bit, or maybe they were used a little bit superficially. And I guess the one that finally got me at the end is when Surek's Katra is introduced to Archer.
Yeah.
Because I felt like suddenly we went from this very interesting real-world story, and we introduced this magical element into the story that somehow now Archer has the Katra of Surik in him. And now they're able to do things that they kind of have an easy way out in terms of moving the story forward. And I was also thinking that, you know, maybe if this had never happened before in terms of someone taking on a Katra or having side effects of a mind meld, it would have been different for me. But of course, we have the famous case of Spock putting his Katra into McCoy, which we just talked about. We have the case where Spock put his Katra in Nurse Chapel temporarily. And then we have the scene with, it's not a Katra transfer, but we have the mind meld with Sarek and Kirk in Star Trek III. And then
I thought you were going to talk about that time that the Andorian comes out and starts fighting and Spock puts his Katra in him.
You have the first move.
Right. That happened also, but yeah. So anyway, when it happened here, for me, it was a little bit like, okay, great. So we're going to do this again. The captain gets the Katra. We're going to do this again. And now there's this magical element in the story. And I mean, it doesn't break the story for me, but I did feel like there was a little bit of fanboyism going on here with some of the Vulcan elements as they were used in the story.
Well, I am a Star Trek apologist. I am. I love it all, and yeah, I don't agree with that. I think it's not moving the story forward. It is the story, and I think what they did with it, with the flashbacks where he's talking with Surak, and again, as a certified geek, I'm in this story, and they're showing Surak, and I'm thinking, oh my god, this is the episode of Surak. We actually are learning his backstory and seeing all this. Much more so than thinking, oh, this is the fifth time in 750 hours we've seen a Katra transferred. That's not a big deal. So there's my reinforcement.
If you also accept that, you know, Sisko was the Sisko and he was the emissary and he, you know, he helped them, you know, defeat the power race and, you know, change the culture. And if you accept that Picard, basically was the, well, they called him the Arbiter of Secession, right? Where he was the one who was in charge of determining who was going to be in charge. I mean, our captains do some
Klingon
pretty...
The Klingon Empire, right?
That's great,
the Klingon
yeah.
Empire, yes. Our captains do some pretty impressive stuff. So for the thing that Archer does to be, he takes on the Katra of, you know, the guy who originated Vulcan religion, I just buy into it as that's a thing that Star Trek does. And if it's, if the Katra is a little bit silly, well, we kind of just need to blame the writers of Star Trek III because they introduced the element and gave Judith and Garfield the out they needed. Like, how can you not introduce that? If you're in the story and you've got Archer on Vulcan, yeah, let's go ahead and see him. And I would say it gets a little silly, yeah, in the next episode where he has the flashback conversation with Surak. But yeah, I don't know. It just kind of works for me, like with James, on a pure fanboy level of this is so cool that we're actually seeing him.
That's the thing about Enterprise, like, is that it is just sort of silly at times, and it can be really silly at times, but that's okay because you don't get a lot of fun in Star Trek sometimes. It gets very serious for extremely long lengths of time. And sometimes you just need to have a show that has hallucinogenic pollen, maybe, and excessive use of Katras on your captain. These things just happen on Enterprise. That's why that episode, or this episode arc, works for me, because I just accept it as something silly that's happening on Enterprise that ultimately has a good story behind it and a strong story behind it.
But they do have so much fun with it when he's... I think T'Pol at some point at the end of the Ford says, hey, you need to drink some water. And he says, no, I'm good for another day. She says, you're not Vulcan. And he goes, oh yeah. And grabs the water. I love that. There's a lot of moments like that in the next 2 hours.
Yeah.
Well, just for the record too, now, I'm not saying that I think the Katra is silly. I'm just
Nor do I.
Thinking that maybe I wanted, I don't know. I mean, I'm fine with the way it all played out. It all works for me. It's fine. It's just that when it happens, I sometimes feel like, well, we were heading down this one path and then suddenly we're going to do this. It's just a feeling I have.
When do we ever go down the path we think we're going on Enterprise? When has that ever happened?
That is quite true.
Well, the time when Porthos eats cheese and he gets gassy, that's exactly what Captain Archer told you was going to happen. That is a straight path. So
that's fair.
Yeah. Hey, the Katra is serious business.
It really is. All right, well, we're getting close to an hour, so why don't we wrap up with our final thoughts about the Forge?
I can say without hesitation, this is my favorite episode of Star Trek Enterprise, and not just because of my connection to it and this arc, but because of the grand epic scope and the way it connects to the original series and the way it rewards someone who's, you know, been so invested for the length of the five series. So for me, I just the way they brought it all together was perfect.
I definitely love these episodes because it gets us off of the Enterprise for more than an episode. We get an extreme length of time with just T'Pol and Archer sort of expanding on their relationship, which gets sort of set aside for a while, I think, in seasons 3 and 4. And I definitely miss that going into the last season because they're the two commanding officers. You definitely want them to show their relationship. And it has a lot of fun in it, too, which is my favorite part of Enterprise, is that it's not so serious all the time and that you can just sort of smile and enjoy it a lot of the time.
Yeah, definitely. I guess what I would say is the thing we haven't talked about too much is that they went on location, and I loved that. I mean, yes, eventually they get to the planet Hellset, but there's an awful lot of it that, as James was talking about, it is the desert in California, and we see, you know, an actual animal, like an alien animal, which we hardly ever see. That's just that was really cool to me when the sandstorm is like a lightning storm on the desert. It just really worked for me and sold me on this location in a way that Stargate Universe eventually did, like 10 years later. But here again is Enterprise doing it way before anyone else did. So I definitely give this episode 9 Katras out of 10.
I agree on the location. It's one of the things that I noticed, that it was nice to be on an alien planet that was hospitable, that didn't look like California.
Yeah.
For a change. And they did a great job shooting on location outside of Los Angeles and still filtering it in a way that made it really feel like you were on another planet and you were on Vulcan. And this episode feels very real to me. Yes, getting off the ship is wonderful. And I just love being able to see Vulcan, not only on the surface, but, you know, at the beginning when they're down in the caves and he's finding the Kirshara. It's a great episode. And I like the fleshing out of the Vulcans. I wish more people had been watching the series at this point so they could actually see where that concept of the Vulcans was going and how it ultimately leads us to what we know.
Yeah, I checked out at this point. You know, I left when I was watching live. I left during season 3, came back, saw the alien Nazis, and I was out again. So I didn't
you
actually
mean the Riemanns?
Yes, the Riemann Nazis. I didn't see this stuff until just, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And I was like, oh, wow, I really should have been watching this.
It is great. I think now with Netflix, for me in Japan, it's Hulu. And the DVDs, of course, are out and the Blu-rays coming out. That people rediscovering the series. With the separation of 10 years now, you don't connect it with what you thought should have happened after Voyager. And you can appreciate the series. I hope people watch it all the way through. Someone told me on Twitter yesterday that Enterprise lost me in season 3 and I quit watching.
Mm, yeah.
I said, well, it's really too bad because the fourth season is what I think most Star Trek fans really wanted out of Enterprise. The fourth season is what everyone needs to see if they wanted that connection. So, but they did lose people. But anyway, That at least they didn't get boy bands in the mess hall.
Yes.
Thank goodness that didn't happen. So I love this episode. The whole fourth season, the last thing I'll say about this, the concept of using three episodes to tell stories in the fourth season is fantastic because they don't have to rush through things. They can go into the details and they have breathing room to actually tell a story. And I'm kind of surprised. I guess UPN let them do it because it was kind of becoming the nature of television at the time to tell these serialized stories anyway. But also maybe they knew the show was on its way out. So what the hell? Let's just let them do whatever they want to do. But it works really well. And there's so much good stuff in the fourth season. So I'm going to give this episode 9 non-climbing saluts.
Right.
All right. Well, Catherine and James, thanks so much for joining us today. And before we go, Catherine, tell everyone where they can find you around the internets.
They can find me on Twitter under @HawkeyedPoet and also on the Observation Lounge with our Greg Harbin here as well.
And I am at Enterprise Extra at Twitter, at Enterprise Extra. And hopefully I'll be back at some point.
We'll have to bring the whole crew together to do The Awakening and Kirshara, right? You know, in the coming years when we get back to doing this.
That's right. Yeah, we need to get to the other parts quickly. Right. If we do like one part of the trilogy per year, I think it's going to be kind of hard for people to follow our thought process on this.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us today, guys.
Happily, I was able to work through my severe muscle pain to discuss Enterprise with you. I still have not recovered from carrying the television. But I had an awful lot of fun talking about the Fort. I do wonder, are we going to do Awakening, you know, maybe next year, maybe yesterday? I'm sure we'll get back to it at some point. Because I do want to talk about the rest of this arc. It's a fantastic arc of TV. It's a fantastic arc of Enterprise. I don't know if I'd go out on a limb like James did and say this is my favorite episode of Enterprise, but it certainly is up there.
Right. Now, it could have been worse, Greg. You could have carried your TV through the Forge. That would have been really tough. Especially when you had the Salats nipping at your heels all the way home.
I just would have let the Salat have it. It's fine.
But yeah, I'm with you. It's not my favorite episode of Enterprise, but it's definitely one of the best episodes of Enterprise, and the three-story arc is some of the best storytelling on Enterprise, for sure, and some of the best storytelling in all of Star Trek. If you're listening to this and you haven't seen this episode, or if you tuned out of Enterprise in the third season, really go watch this stuff, because yeah, it's really great. And if you like Vulcans, this is where you get your background. Excellent episode, and great writing by Judith and Garfield. And as far as when we talk about the next ones, yeah, we have to figure out how to do that. I don't know if we want to do three consecutive Ready Rooms where we only talk about these three episodes or not, but I don't want to have a lot of lag time talking about them either. So we'll figure it out.
Because either way, it's going to be a month and a half before we get back to it.
I know. It's going to take us like 3 months to get through them, even with our cycle, but we'll get through there. So great stuff. We should take a moment, Greg, and you know, this show is going to be coming out right at Christmas time, so we should take a moment and wish all of our listeners happy holidays.
Yes, definitely. It's been a wonderful second Christmas for me here in Seattle. I'm glad to have made a lot of friends over the years and be able to share an e-Christmas with all of you, as well as the new year. I'm expecting this to be quite fun. I'm really looking forward to starting 2013. You know, that'll be our third year of podcasting here at Trek FM, and I'm really excited
for it. That's amazing. That's really amazing to think that we've been doing it that long now. But but definitely, you know, whatever holiday you celebrate, for me here in Japan, our big holiday is New Year's. So I'm looking forward to next week when everything kind of winds down a little bit, have a little bit of quiet time. We are going to be taking a week off next week, so there will be no Ready Room. And we're going to give everyone a break from podcasting a little bit,
right.
Let everyone recover from the holidays, and then we'll jump into 2013 with more Star Trek podcasting, even more than we've done at any point so far. So we really appreciate everyone sticking with us and listening.
I'm planning to start at least one new show every month next year, so you can look forward to that. We're going to have, you know, I already have the Observation Lounge and the Ready Room. You can look forward to the Captain's Dining Hall, Riker's Bedroom. I know we already have Deck 8, but you don't have a show specifically in Riker's Bedroom, so I'm going to be bringing right. that to you.
Not in the bed area itself, yeah. All right. So, yes, thank you, everyone, for another great year on the Ready Room. So, Greg, let's tell everyone where they can contact us if they'd like to share their thoughts on any of the news items today or on The Forge. You can go to trek.fm/contact, and you'll find a form there. Send a message to the Ready Room. That'll come to Greg and myself. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, on Google Plus at hyperchannel/trekfmgplus, on ADN under username TrekFM, and of course on Twitter at username TrekFM, where Greg, myself, Char, and Landru are tweeting from the same account all the time. So hit us up there with any of your Star Trek questions. And Greg, what if people want to find you personally? Where should they go?
Right. If you're excited to know about my opinions on sports ball, now that the Seahawks are making it into the playoffs after their rout of the 49ers tonight, you can definitely find me at Greg Harbin. That's GregHarbin. Also find me, as I said, elsewhere on Trek FM at the Observation Lounge, where I, Landru, and Catherine Bryan get together, usually with one other person, to discuss the week in geeky news. And the last show, sort of a holiday show, is about trailers for 2013 films. So we had an awful lot of fun. It's, I think, our best Observation Lounge yet. So if you haven't tuned in yet, please check out that last show.
And also check out all the other shows we have on the network as well, along with the Observation Lounge. We have 10 shows altogether now. If you go to trekfm/PD for podcast directory, that short link will get you right to the list of all the shows. You can find me on the network besides this show over on Literary Treks with Matthew Rushing, where we talk exclusively about books and comics, and we interview authors. So we've had some great interviews with a lot of the best-known authors in Star Trek right now. You can find me from time to time on MatterStream. It's not a regular show, but when I can hook up with some great people to interview outside of the usual Star Trek, I do that over there. So check that out as well, all at trek.fm. And we'd also like to thank our sponsor this week, Squarespace. Be sure to go to squarespace.com/trek, where you can try the web's best system for building websites and blogs. And if you use code TREK12, you'll be able to get 10% off when you sign up for Squarespace. So we thank Squarespace for their support of Trek FM and the Ready Room. Right. And please go support them and the network. It makes it possible for us to bring all these shows to you. Okay, Greg. Well, I think that covers pretty much everything this week.
Yeah, I think so.
So I'm going to wander off through the caves here. You know, I've heard rumor that there is a missing book to the Kirshara, and I'm going to go see if I can find that one as well.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to stick a mind meld consent form in it, because the Ready Room is done.